He did not hurt her intentionally. And tonight, for perhaps the 10th or 11th time since they had been married, she had a climax. She let herself go to him, eyes closed, feeling the shelf of his chin dig into the top of her head. She stifled the cry that rose to her lips. It would have made him suspicious if she had cried out. She was not sure he really knew that what always happened at the end for men sometimes happened for women, too. Not long after, and still an hour before Brett came home from the Bergerons, he left her, not telling her where he was going. She surmised it was down to Gary Pervier's, where the drinking would start. She lay in bed and wondered if what she had done and what she had promised could ever be worth it. Tears tried to come, and she drove them back. She lay hot-eyed and straight in bed. And just before Brett came in, his arrival announced by Cujo's barks and the slam of the back door screen, the moon rose in all its silvery, detached glory. "Moon doesn't care," Charity thought. But the thought brought her no comfort. "What is it?" Donna asked. Her voice was dull, almost defeated. The two of them were sitting in the living room. Vic had not gotten home until nearly Tad's bedtime, and that was now half an hour past. He was sleeping in his room upstairs, the monster words tacked up by his bed, the closet door firmly shut. Vic got up and crossed to the window, which now looked out only on darkness. "She knows," he thought glumly. "Not the fine tuning, maybe, but she's getting a pretty clear picture." All the way home he had tried to decide if he should confront her with it, lance the boil, try living with the laudable pus, or if he should just deep-six it. After leaving Deering Oaks, he had torn the letter up, and on his way home, up 302, he had fed the scraps out the window. "Litterbug Trenton," he thought. And now the choice had been taken out of his hands. He could see her pale reflection in the dark glass, her face a white circle in yellow lamplight. He turned toward her, having absolutely no idea what he was going to say. "He knows," Donna was thinking. It was not a new thought, not by now, because the last 3 hours had been the longest 3 of her whole life. She had heard the knowledge in his voice when he called to say he would be home late. At first there had been panic, the raw fluttering panic of a bird trapped in a garage. The thought had been in italics, followed by comic book exclamation points. "He knows! He knows! He knows!" She had gotten Tad his supper in a fog of fear, trying to see what might logically happen next, but she was unable. "I'll wash the dishes next," she thought, "then dry them, then put them away, then read Tad some stories. Then I'll just sail off the edge of the world." Panic had been superseded by guilt. Terror had followed the guilt. Then a kind of fatalistic apathy had settled in as certain emotional circuits quietly shut themselves down. The apathy was even tinged by a certain relief. The secret was out. She wondered if Steve had done it or if Vic had guessed on his own. She rather thought it had been Steve, but it didn't really matter. There was also relief that Tad was in bed, safely asleep. But she wondered what sort of morning he would wake up to. And that thought brought her full circle to her original panicky fear again. She felt sick, lost. He turned toward her from the window and said,
"I got a letter today. An unsigned letter."
He couldn't finish. He crossed the room again, restlessly, and she found herself thinking what a handsome man he was, and that it was too bad he was going gray so early. It looked good on some young men, but on Vic it was just going to make him look prematurely old, And what was she thinking about his hair for? It wasn't his hair she had to worry about, was it? Very softly, still hearing the shake in her voice, she said everything that was salient, spitting it out like some horrible medicine too bitter to swallow. Steve Kemp, the man who refinished your desk in the den. 5 times. Never in our bed, Vic. Never.
Vic put out his hand for the pack of Winston's on the end table by the sofa and knocked it onto the floor. He picked it up, got one out, and lit it. His hands were shaking badly. They weren't looking at each other.
That's bad, Donna thought. We should be looking at each other. But she couldn't be the one to start. She was scared and ashamed. He was only scared.
Why?
Does it matter?
It matters to me. It means a lot. Unless you want to cut loose. If you do, I guess it doesn't matter. I'm mad as hell, Donna. I'm trying not to let that part of it get on top, because if we never talk straight again, we have to do it now. Do you want to cut loose?
Look at me, Vic. With a great effort, he did. Maybe he was as mad as he said he was, but she could see only a species of miserable fright. Suddenly, like the thud of a boxing glove on her mouth, she saw how close to the edge of everything he was. The agency was tottering, that was bad enough, and now, on top of that, like a grisly dessert following a putrid main course, his marriage was tottering too. She felt a rush of warmth for him, for this man she had sometimes hated, and had, for the last 3 hours at least, feared. A kind of epiphany filled her. Most of all, she hoped he would always think he had been as mad as hell, and not the way his face said he felt. "I don't want to cut loose," she said. "I love you. These last few weeks, I think I've just found that out again." He looked relieved for a moment. He went back to the window, then returned to the couch. He dropped down there and looked at her.
Why, then?
The epiphany was lost in low-key, exasperated anger.
Why?
It was a man's question. Its origin lay far down in whatever the concept of masculinity was in an intelligent late 20th-century Western man.
I have to know why you did it.
As if she were a car with a stuck needle valve that had caused the machine to start hitching and sputtering, or a robot that had gotten its servo tape scrambled so that it was serving meatloaf in the morning and scrambled eggs for dinner. What drove women crazy, she thought suddenly, wasn't really sexism at all, maybe. It was this mad, masculine quest for efficiency. I don't know if I can explain. I'm afraid it will sound stupid and petty and trivial.
Try. Was it?
He cleared his throat, seemed to mentally spit on his hands, that cursed efficiency thing again, and then fairly wrenched the thing out.
Haven't I been satisfying you? Was that it?
No, she said.
Then what? He said helplessly. For Christ's sake, what?
Okay. You asked for it. Fear, she said. Mostly, I think it was fear.
Fear?
When Tad went to school, there was nothing to keep me from being afraid. Tad was like, what do they call it? White noise. The sound the TV makes when it isn't tuned to a station that comes in.
He wasn't in real school, Vic said quickly.
and she knew he was getting ready to be angry, getting ready to accuse her of trying to lay it off on Tad. And once he was angry, things would come out between them that shouldn't be spoken, at least not yet. There were things, being the woman she was, that she would have to rise to. The situation would escalate. Something that was now very fragile was being tossed from his hands to hers and back again. It could easily be dropped. That was part of it, she said. He wasn't in real school. I still had him most of the time, and the time when he was gone, there was a contrast. She looked at him. The quiet seemed very loud by comparison. That was when I started to get scared. Kindergarten next year, I'd think. Half a day every day instead of half a day 3 times a week. The year after that, all day, 5 days a week. And there would still be all those hours to fill up. And I just got scared.
"So you thought you'd fill up a little of that time by fucking someone?" he asked bitterly. That stung her, but she continued on grimly, tracing it out as best she could, not raising her voice. He had asked. She would tell him.
"I didn't want to be on the library committee, and I didn't want to be on the hospital committee, and run the bake sales, or be in charge of getting the starter change, or making sure that not everybody is making the same hamburger helper casserole for the Saturday night supper. I didn't want to see those same depressing faces over and over again, and listen to the same gossipy stories about who is doing what in this town. I didn't want to sharpen my claws on anyone else's reputation." The words were gushing out of her now. She couldn't have stopped them if she wanted to. "I didn't want to sell Tupperware, and I didn't want to sell Amway, and I didn't want to give Stanley parties, and I don't need to join Weight Watchers. You..." She paused for the tiniest second, grasping it, feeling the weight of the idea. "You don't know about emptiness, Vic. Don't think you do. You're a man, and men grapple. Men grapple and women dust. You dust the empty rooms and you listen to the wind blowing outside sometimes. Only sometimes it seems like the wind's inside, you know? So you put on a record, Bob Seger or J.J. Cale or someone, and you can still hear the wind. And thoughts come to you, ideas, nothing good, but they come. So you clean both toilets, and you do the sink, and one day you're down in one of the antique shops looking at little pottery knick-knacks, and you think about how your mother had a shelf of knick-knacks like that, and your aunts all had shelves of them, and your grandmother had them as well. He was looking at her closely, and his expression was so honestly perplexed that she felt a wave of her own despair. "It's feelings I'm talking about, not facts."
"Yes, but why?"
"I'm telling you why. I'm telling you that I got so I was spending enough time in front of the mirror to see how my face was changing, how no one was ever going to mistake me for a teenager again, or ask to see my driver's license when I ordered a drink in a bar. I started to be afraid because I grew up, after all. Tad's going to preschool, and that means he's going to go to school, then high school."
"Are you saying you took a lover because you felt old?"
He was looking at her, surprised, and she loved him for that, because she supposed that was a part of it. Steve Kemp had found her attractive, and of course that was flattering. That was what had made the flirtation fun in the first place. But it was in no way the greatest part of it. She took his hands and spoke earnestly into his face, thinking, knowing, that she might never speak so earnestly or honestly to any man again. "It's more. It's knowing you can't wait any longer to be a grown-up, or wait any longer to make your peace with what you have. It's knowing that your choices are being narrowed almost daily. For a woman, no, for me, that's a brutal thing to have to face. Wife, that's fine, but you're gone at work. Even when you're home, you're gone at work so much. Mother, that's fine too, but there's a little less of it every year. Because every year the world gets another little slice of him. Men, they know what they are. They have an image of what they are. They never live up to the ideal, and it breaks them. And maybe that's why so many men die unhappy and before their time. But they know what being a grown-up is supposed to mean. They have some kind of handle on 30, 40, 50. They don't hear that wind, or if they do, they find a lance and tilt at it, thinking it must be a windmill or some fucking thing that needs knocking down. And what a woman does, what I did, was to run from becoming. I got scared of the way the house sounded when Tad was gone. Once, do you know, this is crazy. I was in his room, changing the sheets, and I got thinking about these girlfriends I had in high school, wondering what happened to them, where they went. I was almost in a daze. And Tad's closet door swung open, and I screamed and ran out of the room. I don't know why, except I guess I do. I thought for just a second there that Joan Brady would come out of Tad's closet, and her head would be gone, and there would be blood all over her clothes, and she would say, "I died in a car crash when I was 19 coming back from Sammy's Pizza, and I don't give a damn." "Christ, Donna," Vic said. "I got scared, that's all. I got scared when I'd start looking at knick-knacks or thinking about taking a pottery course or yoga or something like that. And the only place to run from the future is into the past. So I started flirting with him." She looked down and then suddenly buried her face in her hands. Her words were muffled but still understandable. "It was fun. It was like being in college again. It was like a dream, a stupid dream. It was like he was white noise. He blotted out that wind sound. The flirting part was fun. The sex, it was no good. I had orgasms, but it was no good. I can't explain why not, except that I still loved you through all of it, and understood that I was running away." She looked up at him again, crying now. "He's running, too. He's made a career of it. He's a poet, at least that's what he calls himself. I couldn't make head or tail of the things he showed me. He's a roadrunner, dreaming he's still in college and protesting the war in Vietnam. That's why it was him, I guess. And now I think you know everything I can tell you. An ugly little tale, but mine own."
"I'd like to beat him up," Vic said. "If I could make his nose bleed, I guess that would make me feel better."
She smiled wanly. "He's gone. Tad and I went for a Dairy Queen after we finished supper, and you still weren't home. There's a for rent sign in the window of his shop. I told you he was a roadrunner."
"There was no poetry in that note," Vic said.
He looked at her briefly, then down again. She touched his face, and he winced back a little. That hurt more than anything else, hurt more than she would have believed. The guilt and fear came again in a glassy, crushing wave, but she wasn't crying anymore. She thought there would be no more tears for a very long time. The wound and the attendant shock trauma were too great. "Vic," she said, "I'm sorry. You're hurt, and I'm sorry."
"When did you break it off?"
She told him about the day she had come back and found him there, omitting the fear she'd had that Steve might actually rape her.
"Then the note was his way of getting back at you."
She brushed hair away from her forehead and nodded. Her face was pale and wan. There were purplish patches of skin under her eyes. "I guess so."
"Let's go upstairs," he said. "It's late. We're both tired."
"Will you make love to me?" He shook his head slowly.
"Not tonight."
"All right." They went to the stairs together. At the foot of them, Donna asked, "So what comes next, Vic?" He shook his head.
"I just don't know."
"Do I write, 'I promise never to do it again,' 500 times on the blackboard and miss recess? Do we get a divorce? Do we never mention it again? What?" She didn't feel hysterical, only tired, but her voice was rising in a way she didn't like and hadn't intended. The shame was the worst, the shame of being found out and seeing how it had punched his face in. And she hated him as well as herself for making her feel so badly ashamed, because she didn't believe she was responsible for the factors leading up to the final decision, if there really had been a decision.
"We ought to be able to get it together," he said.
But she did not mistake him. He wasn't talking to her.
"This thing..."
He looked at her pleadingly.
"He was the only one, wasn't he?"
It was the one unforgivable question, the one he had no right to ask. She left him, almost ran up the stairs, before everything could spill out, the stupid recriminations and accusations that would not solve anything but only muddy up whatever poor honesty they had been able to manage. There was little sleep for either of them that night. And the fact that he had forgotten to call Joe Camber and ask him if he could work on his wife's ailing Pinto runabout was the furthest thing from Vic's mind. As for Joe Camber himself, he was sitting with Gary Pervier in one of the decaying lawn chairs which dotted Gary's run-to-riot side yard. They were drinking vodka martinis out of McDonald's glasses under the stars. Lightning bugs flickered across the dark, and the masses of honeysuckle clinging to Gary's fence filled the hot night with its cloying heavy scent. Cujo would ordinarily have been chasing after the fireflies, sometimes barking and tickling both men no end. But tonight he only lay between them with his nose on his paws. They thought he was sleeping, but he wasn't. He simply lay there, feeling the aches that filled his bones and buzzed back and forth in his head. It had gotten hard for him to think what came next in his simple dog's life. Something had gotten in the way of ordinary instinct. When he slept, he had dreams of uncommon, unpleasant vividity. In one of these, he had savaged the boy, had ripped his throat open, and then pulled his guts out of his body in steaming bundles. He had awakened from this dream, twitching and whining. He was continually thirsty, but he had already begun to shy away from his water dish some of the time, and when he did drink, the water tasted like steel shavings. The water made his teeth ache. The water sent bolts of pain through his eyes. And now he lay on the grass, not caring about the lightning bugs or anything else.
The voices of the men were unimportant rumbles coming from somewhere above him. They meant little to him compared to his own growing misery.
"Boston," Gary Pervier said and cackled. "Boston! What the hell are you going to do in Boston? And what makes you think I could afford to tag along? I don't think I got enough to go down to the Norge until I get my check cashed."
"Fuck you. You're rolling in it," Joe replied. He was getting pretty drunk.
"You might have to dig into what's in your mattress a little, that's all."
"Nothing in there but bedbugs," Gary said and cackled again. "Place is crawling with them, and I don't give a shit. You ready for another blast?"
Joe held out his glass. Gary had the makings right beside his chair. He mixed in the dark with the practiced, steady, and heavy hand of the chronic drinker.
"Boston," he said again, handing Joe his drink.
He said slyly,
"Kicking up your heels, little Joey, I guess."
Gary was the only man in Castle Rock, perhaps the world, who could have gotten away with calling him Joey.
"Kicking up some whoopee, I guess. Never known you to go further than Portsmouth before." "I've been to Boston once or twice," Joe said. "You better look out, pervert, or I'll sick my dog on you."
"You couldn't sick that dog on a yelling nigger with a straight razor in each hand," Gary said.
He reached down and ruffled Cujo's fur briefly.
"What's your wife say about it?"
"She don't know we're going. She don't have to know."
"Oh, yeah?"
"She's taken the boy down to Connecticut to see her sister and that freak she's married to. They're gonna be gone a week. She won some money in the lottery. Might as well tell you that right out. They use all the names on the radio anyway. It's all in the prize form she had to sign."
"Won some money in the lottery, did she?"
$5,000.
Gary whistled. Cujo flicked his ears uncomfortably at the sound. Joe told Gary what Charity had told him at supper, leaving out the argument and making it appear a straight trade that had been his idea. The boy could go down to Connecticut for a week with her and up to Moosehead for a week with him in the fall.
"And you're gonna go down to Boston and spend some of that dividend yourself, you dirty dog," Gary said.
He clapped Joe on the shoulder and laughed. "Ho-ho! You're a one, all right."
"Why shouldn't I? You know when the last time was I had a day off? I don't. Can't remember. I ain't got much on this week. I plan to take most of a day and a half pulling the motor on Richie's International, doing a valve job and all, but with that chain fall, it won't take 4 hours. I'll get him to bring it in tomorrow, and I can do it tomorrow afternoon. I got a transmission job, but that's just a teacher from the grammar school. I can put that back. A few other things the same way. I'll just call him up and tell him I'm having a little holiday."
"What you gonna do down in Beantown?"
"Well, maybe see the Dead Sox play a couple at Fenway. Go down there to Washington Street. The combat zone. Hot damn, I knew it."
Gary snorted laughter and slapped his leg. "See some of those dirty shows and try to catch the clap."
"Wouldn't be very much fun alone."
"Well, I guess I could tag along with you if you was willing to put some of that money my way until I get my check cashed."
"I'd do that," Joe said.
Gary was a drunkard, but he took a debt seriously.
"I ain't been with a woman for about 4 years, I guess," Gary said reminiscently. lost most of the old sperm factory over there in France. What's left? Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. Might be fun to find out if I still got any ram left in my ramrod.
Yeah, Joe said. He was slurring now, and his ears were buzzing.
And don't forget the baseball. You know when the last time was I went to Fenway?
No.
1968, Joe said, leaning forward and tapping out each syllable on Gary's arm for emphasis.
He spilled most of his new drink in the process.
Before my kid was born, they played the Tigers and lost 6-4, those suckers. Nahm Cash hit a homer in the top of the eighth.
When you thinking of going?
Monday afternoon around 3, I thought. The wife and the boy will want to go out that morning, I guess. I'll take them to the Greyhound station in Portland. That gives me the rest of the morning and half the afternoon to catch up whatever I have to catch up.
You taking the car or the truck?
Car.
Gary's eyes went soft and dreamy in the dark.
"Booze, baseball, and broads," he said.
He sat up straighter.
"I don't give a shit if I do."
"You want to go?"
"Yeah."
Joe let out a little whoop, and they both got laughing. Neither noticed that Cujo's head had come off his paws at the sound, and that he was growling very softly. Monday morning dawned in shades of pearl and dark gray. The fog was so thick that Brett Camber couldn't see the oak in the side yard from his window, and that oak wasn't but 30 yards away. The house still slept around him, but there was no more sleep left in him. He was going on a trip, and every part of his being vibrated with that news. Just he and his mother. It would be a good trip. He felt that, and deep down inside, beyond any conscious thought, he was glad his father wasn't coming. He would be free to be himself. He would not have to try to live up to some mysterious ideal of masculinity that he knew his father had achieved, but which he himself couldn't yet even begin to comprehend. He felt good, incredibly good, and incredibly alive. He felt sorry for anyone in the world who was not going on a trip this fine foggy morning, which would be another scorcher as soon as the fog burned off. He planned to sit in a window seat of the bus and watch every mile of the journey from the Greyhound terminal on Spring Street all the way to Stratford. It had been a long time before he had been able to get to sleep last night, and here it was, not yet 5 o'clock, but if he stayed in bed any longer he would explode or something. Moving as quietly as he could, he put on jeans and his Castle Rock Cougars t-shirt, a pair of white athletic socks, and his Keds. He went downstairs and fixed himself a bowl of Cocoa Bears. He tried to eat quietly, but was sure that the crunch of the cereal that he heard in his head must be audible all over the house. Upstairs he heard his dad grunt and turn over in the double bed he and his mom shared. The springs rasped. Brett's jaws froze. After a moment's debate, he took his second bowl of Cocoa Bears out on the back porch, being careful not to let the screen door slam. The summer smells of everything were greatly clarified in the heavy fog, and the air was already warm. In the east, just above the faint fuzz that marked a belt of pines at the end of the east pasture, he could see the sun. It was as small and silver-bright as the full moon when it has risen well up in the sky. Even now, the humidity was a dense thing, heavy and quiet. The fog would be gone by 8 or 9, but the humidity would remain. But for now, what Brett saw was a white, secret world, and he was filled with the secret joys of it, the husky smell of hay that would be ready for its first cutting in a week, of manure, of his mother's roses.
He could even faintly make out the aroma of Gary Pervier's triumphant honeysuckle, which was slowly burying the fence which marked the edge of his property, burying it in a drift of cloying, grasping vines. He put his cereal bowl aside and walked toward where he knew the barn to be. Halfway across the dooryard, he looked over his shoulder and saw that the house had receded to nothing but a misty outline. A few steps farther, and it was swallowed. He was alone in the white, with only the tiny silver sun looking down on him. He could smell dust, damp, honeysuckle, roses. And then the growling began. His heart leaped into his throat, and he fell back a step, all his muscles tensing into bundles of wire. His first panicky thought, like a child who has suddenly tumbled into a fairy tale, was wolf, and he looked around wildly. There was nothing to see but white. Cujo came out of the fog. Brett began to make a whining noise in his throat. The dog he had grown up with, the dog who had pulled a yelling, gleeful 5-year-old Brett patiently around and around the dooryard on his flexible flyer, buckled into a harness Joe had made in the shop. The dog who had been waiting calmly by the mailbox every afternoon during school for the bus, come shine or shower. That dog bore only the slightest resemblance to the muddy, matted apparition slowly materializing from the morning mist. The St. Bernard's big, sad eyes were now reddish and stupid and lowering, more pig's eyes than dog's eyes. His coat was plated with brownish-green mud, as if he had been rolling around in the boggy place at the bottom of the meadow. His muzzle was wrinkled back in a terrible mock grin that froze Brett with horror. Brett felt his heart slugging away in his throat. Thick white foam dripped slowly from between Cujo's teeth.
"Cujo?" Brett whispered. "Cuj?"
Cujo looked at the boy, not recognizing him anymore, not his looks, not the shadings of his clothes. He could not precisely see colors, at least as human beings understand them, not his scent. What he saw was a monster on two legs. Cujo was sick, and all things appeared monstrous to him now. His head clanged dully with murder. He wanted to bite and rip and tear. Part of him saw a cloudy image of him springing at the boy, bringing him down, parting flesh with bone, drinking blood as it still pulsed, driven by a dying heart. Then the monstrous figure spoke, and Cujo recognized his voice. It was the boy. The boy. And the boy had never done him any harm. Once he had loved the boy and would have died for him had that been called for. There was enough of that feeling left to hold the image of murder at bay until it grew as murky as the fog around them. It broke up and rejoined the buzzing, clamorous river of his sickness.
"Cujo? What's wrong, boy?"
The last of the dog that had been before the bat scratched its nose turned away, and the sick and dangerous dog, subverted for the last time, was forced to turn with it. Cujo stumbled away and moved deeper into the fog. Foam splattered from his muzzle onto the dirt. He broke into a lumbering run, hoping to outrun the sickness, but it ran with him, buzzing and yammering, making him ache with hatred and murder. He began to roll over and over in the high timothy grass, snapping at it, his eyes rolling. The world was a crazy sea of smells. He would track each to its source and dismember it. Cujo began to growl again. He found his feet. He slipped deeper into the fog that was even now beginning to thin. a big dog who weighed just under 200 pounds. Brett stood in the dooryard for more than 15 minutes after Cujo had melted back into the fog, not knowing what to do. Cujo had been sick. He might have eaten a poison bait or something. Brett knew about rabies, and if he had ever seen a woodchuck or a fox or a porcupine exhibiting the same symptoms, he would have guessed rabies. But it never crossed his mind that his dog could have that awful disease of the brain and the nervous system. A poison bait, that seemed the most likely. He should tell his father. His father could call the vet. Or maybe Dad could do something himself, like that time 2 years ago when he had pulled the porcupine needles out of Cujo's muzzle with his pliers, working each quill first up, then down, then out, being careful not to break them off because they would fester in there. Yes, he would have to tell Dad. Dad would do something, like that time Cuj got into it with Mr. Porcupine. But what about the trip? He didn't need to be told that his mother had won them the trip through some desperate stratagem, or luck, or a combination of the two. Like most children, he could sense the vibrations between his parents, and he knew the way the emotional currents ran from one day to the next, the way a veteran guide knows the twists and turns of an upcountry river. It had been a near thing. And even though his dad had agreed, Brett sensed that this agreement had been grudging and unpleasant. The trip was not on for sure until he had dropped them off and driven away. If he told Dad Cujo was sick, might he not seize on that as an excuse to keep them home? He stood motionless in the dooryard. He was, for the first time in his life, in a total mental and emotional quandary. After a little while, he began to hunt for Cujo behind the barn. He called him in a low voice. His parents were still sleeping, and he knew how sound carried in the morning fog. He didn't find Cujo anywhere, which was just as well for him. The alarm burred Vic awake at 4:45. He got up, shut it off, and blundered down to the bathroom, mentally cursing Roger Breakstone, who could never get to the Portland jetport 20 minutes before check-in like any normal air traveler. Not Roger. Roger was a contingency man. There might always be a flat tire, or a roadblock, or a washout, or an earthquake. Aliens from outer space might decide to touch down on runway 22. He showered, shaved, gobbled vitamins, and went back to the bedroom to dress. The big double bed was empty, and he sighed a little. The weekend he and Donna had just passed hadn't been very pleasant. In fact, he could honestly say he never wanted to go through such a weekend again in his life. They had kept their normal, pleasant faces on for Tad, but Vic had felt like a participant at a masquerade ball. He didn't like to be aware of the muscles in his face at work when he smiled. They had slept in the same bed together, but for the first time the king-sized double seemed too small to Vic. They slept each on one side, the space between them a crisply sheeted no-man's land. He had lain awake both Friday and Saturday nights, morbidly aware of each shift in Donna's weight as she moved, the sound of her nightdress against her body. He found himself wondering if she was awake, too, on her side of the emptiness that lay between them. Last night, Sunday night, they had tried to do something about that empty space in the middle of the bed. The sex part had been moderately successful, if a little tentative. At least neither of them had cried when it was over. For some reason he had been morbidly sure that one of them would do that. But Vic was not sure you could call what they had done making love. He dressed in his summer-weight gray suit, as gray as the early light outside, and picked up his 2 suitcases. One of them was much heavier than the other. That one contained most of the sharp cereals file. Roger had all the graphic layouts. Donna was making waffles in the kitchen. The teapot was on, just beginning to huff and puff. She was wearing his old blue flannel robe. Her face was puffy, as if instead of resting her, sleep had punched her unconscious. "Will the planes fly when it's like this?" she asked.
"It's going to burn off. You can see the sun already."
He pointed at it, and then kissed her lightly on the nape of the neck.
"You shouldn't have gotten up."
"No problem." She lifted the waffle iron's lid and deftly turned a waffle out on a plate. She handed it to him. "I wish you weren't going away." Her voice was low. "Not now. After last night."
"It wasn't that bad, was it?"
"Not like before," Donna said. A bitter, almost secret smile touched her lips and was gone. She beat the waffle mixture with a wire whisk and then poured a ladleful into the waffle iron and dropped its heavy lid. She poured boiling water over a couple of red rose bags and took the cups, one said Vic, the other Donna, over to the table. "Eat your waffle. They're strawberry preserves if you want them." He got the preserves and sat down. He spread some oleo across the top of the waffle and watched it melt into the little squares, just as he had when he was a child. The preserves were Schmucker's. He liked Schmucker's preserves. He spread the waffle liberally with them. It looked great, but he wasn't hungry. "Will you get laid in Boston or New York?" she asked, turning her back on him. "Even it out? Tit for tat?" He jumped a little, perhaps even flushed. He was glad her back was turned because he felt that at that precise moment there was more of him on his face than he wanted her to see. Not that he was angry. The thought of giving the bellman a 10 instead of the usual buck and then asking the fellow a few questions had certainly crossed his mind. He knew that Roger had done it on occasion.
"I'm going to be too busy for anything like that."
"What does the ad say? There's always room for Jell-O?"
"Are you trying to make me mad, Donna, or what?"
"No. Go on and eat. You got to feed the machine." She sat down with a waffle of her own. No oleo for her. A dash of Vermont-made syrup, that was all. "How well we know each other," he thought. "What time are you picking Roger up?" she asked him.
"After some hot negotiations, we've settled on 6.
She smiled again, but this time the smile was warm and fond. He really took that early bird business to heart at some point, didn't he?
"Yeah. I'm surprised he hasn't called yet to make sure I'm up."
The phone rang. They looked at each other across the table, and after a silent, considering pause, they both burst out laughing. It was a rare moment, certainly more rare than the careful lovemaking in the dark the night before. He saw how fine her eyes were, how lucent. They were as gray as the morning mist outside. "Get it quick before it wakes the tatter up," she said. He did. It was Roger. He assured Roger that he was up, dressed, and in a fighting frame of mind. He would pick Roger up on the dot of 6. He hung up, wondering if he would end up telling Roger about Donna and Steve Kemp. Probably not. Not because Roger's advice would be bad. It wouldn't be. But even though Roger would promise not to tell Althea, he most certainly would. And he had a suspicion that Althea would find it difficult to resist sharing such a juicy bit of bridge table gossip. Such careful consideration of the question made him feel depressed all over again. It was as if by trying to work out the problem between them, he and Donna were burying their own body by moonlight.
"Good old Roger," he said, sitting down again.
He tried on a smile, but it felt wrong. The moment of spontaneity was gone. Will you be able to get all of your stuff and all of Roger's into the Jag?
Sure, he said. We'll have to. Althea needs their car, and you've got... Oh, shit, I completely forgot to call Joe Camber about your Pinto.
You had a few other things on your mind, she said. There was faint irony in her voice. That's all right. I'm not going to send Tad to the playground today. He has the sniffles. I may keep him home the rest of the summer, if that suits you. I get into trouble when he's gone. There were tears choking her voice, squeezing it and blurring it, and he didn't know what to say or how to respond. He watched helplessly as she found a Kleenex, blew her nose, wiped her eyes.
Whatever, he said, shaken. Whatever seems best.
He rushed on.
Just give Camber a call. He's always there, and I don't think it would take him 20 minutes to fix it. Even if he has to put in another carb.
Will you think about it while you're gone? She asked. About what we're going to do? The two of us?
Yes, he said.
Good. I will, too. Another waffle?
No, thanks.
The whole conversation was turning surreal. Suddenly, he wanted to be out and gone. Suddenly, the trip felt very necessary and very attractive. The idea of getting away from the whole mess, putting miles between him and it. He felt a sudden jab of anticipation. In his mind, he could see the Delta jet cutting through the unraveling fog and into the blue. "Can I have a waffle?" They both looked around, startled. It was Tad standing in the hallway in his yellow footy pajamas, his stuffed coyote grasped by one ear, his red blanket wrapped around his shoulders. He looked like a small, sleepy Indian. "I guess I could rustle one up," Donna said, surprised. Tad was not a notably early riser.
"Was it the phone, Tad?" Vic asked.
Tad shook his head. "I made myself wake up early so I could say goodbye to you, Daddy. Do you really have to go?"
"It's just for a while."
"It's too long," Tad said blackly. "I put a circle around the day you're coming home on my calendar. Mom showed me which one. I'm going to mark off every day, and she said she'd tell me the monster words every night."
"Well, that's okay, isn't it?"
"Will you call?"
"Every other night," Vic said.
"Every night," Tad insisted. He crawled up into Vic's lap and set his coyote next to Vic's plate. Tad began to crunch up a piece of toast. "Every night, Daddy."
"I can't every night," Vic said, thinking of the back-breaking schedule Roger had laid out on Friday before the letter had come.
"Why not?"
"Because."
"Because your Uncle Roger is a hard taskmaster," Donna said, putting Tad's waffle on the table. "Come on over here and eat. Bring your coyote. Daddy will call us tomorrow night from Boston and tell us everything that happened to him." Tad took his place at the end of the table. He had a large plastic placemat that said Tad. "Will you bring me a toy?"
"Maybe, if you're good. And maybe I'll call tonight so you'll know I got to Boston in one piece."
"Good deal."
Vic watched fascinated as Tad poured a small ocean of syrup over his waffle.
"What kind of toy?"
"We'll see," Vic said.
He watched Tad eat his waffle. It suddenly occurred to him that Tad liked eggs. Scrambled, fried, poached, or hard-boiled, Tad gobbled them up.
"Tad?"
"What, Daddy?"
"If you wanted people to buy eggs, what would you tell them?"
Tad considered. "I'd tell them eggs taste good," he said. Vic met his wife's eyes again, and they had a second moment like the one that had occurred when the phone rang. This time they laughed telepathically. Their goodbyes were light. Only Tad, with his imperfect grasp of how short the future really was, cried. "You'll think about it?" Donna asked him again as he climbed into the Jag.
"Yes."
But driving into Bridgeton to get Roger, what he thought about were those two moments of near-perfect communication. Two in one morning. Not bad. All it took was 8 or 9 years together, roughly a quarter of all the years so far spent on the face of the earth. He got thinking about how ridiculous the whole concept of human communication was. What monstrous, absurd overkill was necessary to achieve even a little. When you'd invested the time and made it good, you had to be careful. Yes, he'd think about it. It had been good between them, and although some of the channels were now closed, filled with God knew how much muck, and some of that muck might still be squirming, plenty of the others seemed open and in reasonably good working order. There had to be some careful thought, but perhaps not too much at once. Things had a way of magnifying themselves. He turned the radio up and began to think about the poor old sharp serial professor. Joe Camber pulled up in front of the Greyhound terminal in Portland at 8:10. The fog had burned off, and the digital clock atop the Casco Bank and Trust read 73 degrees already. He drove with his hat planted squarely on his head, ready to be angry at anyone who pulled out or cut in front of him. He hated to drive in the city. When he and Gary got to Boston, he intended to park the car and leave it until they were ready to come home. They could take the subways if they could puzzle them out, walk if they couldn't. Charity was dressed in her best pants suit. It was a quiet green, and a white cotton blouse with a ruffle at the neck. She was wearing earrings, and this had filled Brett with a mild sense of amazement. He couldn't remember his mother wearing earrings at all, except to church. Brett had caught her alone when she went upstairs to dress after getting Dad his breakfast oatmeal. Joe had been mostly silent, grunting answers to questions in monosyllables, then shutting off conversation entirely by tuning the radio to WCSH for the ball scores. They were both afraid that the silence might presage a ruinous outburst and a sudden change of mind on their trip. Charity had the slacks of her pants suit on and was slipping into her blouse. Brett noted she was wearing a peach-colored bra, and that had also amazed him. He hadn't known his mother had underclothes in any color other than white. "Ma," he said urgently. She turned to him. It seemed almost that she was turning on him. "Did he say something to you?"
"No. No. It's Cujo."
"Cujo? What about Cujo?"
"He's sick."
"What do you mean, sick?" Brett told her about having his second bowl of cocoa bears out on the back steps, about walking into the fog, and how Cujo had suddenly appeared, his eyes red and wild, his muzzle dripping foam.
"And he wasn't walking right," Brett finished. "He was kind of, you know, staggering." "I think I better tell Daddy."
"No!" his mother said fiercely, and grasped him by the shoulders hard enough to hurt. "You do no such thing!" He looked at her, surprised and frightened. She relaxed her grip a little and spoke more quietly. "He just scared you, coming out of the fog like that. There's probably nothing wrong with him at all, right?" Brett groped for the right words to make her understand how terrible Cujo had looked, and how for a moment he had thought the dog was going to turn on him. He couldn't find the words. Maybe he didn't want to find them. If there is something wrong, Charity continued, it's probably just some little thing. He might have gotten a dose of skunk.
I didn't smell any skunk.
Or he might have been running a woodchuck or a rabbit. Might even have jumped a moose down there in that bog. Or he might have eaten some nettles.